For decades, a mystery has haunted Tamworth.
Mark Anthony Haynes' body was discovered on an isolated stretch of train tracks.
No one talked about him. He was just another little black fella.
An ABC True Crime podcast was followed by a fresh inquest.
Everyone was just holding their breath.
If he didn't do it directly, he knows what happened.
With the truth closer than ever, hear the whole story now. Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Most Australian cities have these lovely old museums in their city centres that were built back in the 19th century. They reflected the keen interest that people took at the time in Australia's distinctive animals and plants that often appeared bizarre in the eyes of the rest of the world. Scientists were particularly interested in Australia's beautiful, wild butterflies. And there were collectors too, collectors who would do anything to get hold of some of these rare specimens, like the Ulysses butterfly with its huge electric blue wings fringed with velvety black. And then one day, just after World War II, a curator working at the National Museum of Victoria in Melbourne discovered that thousands of rare and precious butterfly specimens were missing. And a quick check revealed that thousands more had disappeared from museums in Sydney and Adelaide as well. These were a series of heists that were perpetrated by a gentleman adventurer with a trim moustache named Colin Wyatt, who was a ski champion, a mountaineer, a yodeler, and amateur naturalist, a man who travelled the world looking for rare butterflies. And when Scotland Yard in London was alerted to the theft, police descended on his property in Surrey and found some 40,000 stolen butterfly specimens, leading people to wonder, why on earth would a man do such a thing? Walter Marsh is here today. Walter is an Australian historian who's told the story of this caper in his new book, The Butterfly Thief. Hello, Walter.
Hi, Richard. Thanks for having me.
Your previous book was about the young Rupert Murdoch. This is completely different. How did you stumble on this story of the butterfly thief?
It's a great question. So I have always worked in museums. Occasionally I've worked for magazines and in the media. As you know, not a particularly stable profession in this day and age. So my incredible backup plan is, you know, museums and history. So I've kind of drifted in and out of these spaces, and they've always interested me as, you know, places of history where we can, you know, come face to face with these, you know, the material legacies of the past. And after I'd finished my Rupert Murdoch book and, you know, to be blunt, I'd kind of had enough of talking about Rupert Murdoch, I took a job at the South Australian Museum because I was interested in a lot of these stories. I knew that there were a lot of, you know, histories that I wanted to explore and to tell, but I didn't really know my way into them. So until I figured that out, I took this job. And then on day two, I think, the first week of working at the museum, a friend who worked there sort of pulled me aside and said, hey, have you heard this story about the stolen butterflies? And it took, I think, you know, 5 minutes for me to be hooked and to realise this is not only a story I had to investigate, but this is very probably a book I'm going to write.
This is a whole world you've uncovered here, and you can start it at various multiple points. You can start with the arrival of the Endeavour in Australia. You can start in the 1920s, the 1940s, and indeed in 2016. But one place to start, and where you start, is in 1922. It starts with the capture of a specific very beautiful butterfly in Barrington Tops, the region in New South Wales, sort of between Newcastle and Tamworth, that part of the world. How much of a butterfly paradise was Barrington Tops? What kind of why was this so alluring to butterfly specimen collectors?
Well, the naturalists, they called it nature's wonderland. As soon as, you know, word started to spread of, you know, not only butterflies, but also birds and all kinds of wildlife were just sort of thriving up in on the highlands of Barrington Tops. And one of the, he wasn't a scientist, but one of the people that led a lot of those early scientific expeditions from, you know, the mid-1910s to the 1920s was this fellow called Johnny Hobson, who was, you know, his family ran cattle and grew orchards on the tableland. So he kind of knew the land from working it. And he started leading these expeditions up, and all the naturalists that started coming out of the woodwork to follow him, they regarded him as sort of the father of the tops. And one day in 1922, he goes up near this, the sort of landmark is Edward's Hut. That's what's written on later on a specimen label. There's been a snowfall, as that can happen sometimes. And when it does, sometimes you'll find, you know, butterflies that have been blown down from higher altitudes and, you know, the change in temperature leaves them just, you know, lying dead on the ground.
Oh, you mean like an Arctic breeze hits them or an Antarctic breeze hits them and they just drop dead in the air?
Apparently so.
Oh, that's really poignant.
At different times of day, you know, at dusk, in, you know, the peak butterfly season, there'd be kind of cloud-like clusters of butterflies. You can just reach out and grab them. But on this day in October 1922, Johnny Hobson, he's up on the mountain and he sees this butterfly. It's a variety of hair streak. This particular subspecies has never been collected or studied before.
What do you mean by hair streak?
They're kind of the underside of their wings has this sort of silkiness to them that I think the name comes from.
Oh, how lovely. So what was special about this particular butterfly that would later be named for Barrington types? It would be called P. Barringtonensis, I think, given a Latin name or a more colloquial name, the flame hair streak. What was particularly special about this
particular butterfly? Yeah, so to the untrained eye, it looked very similar to some of its cousins, the other varieties of hair streak that you find kind of around Hanging Rock and in Tasmania and other parts of New South Wales. But when you flip it around to the dorsal side, there are these two kind of red markings on each side of its wing, and that is what sets it apart. That is what makes it what scientists would later call its nickname, the flame hair streak.
Oh, is it beautiful then?
It is, yeah.
You say this was called a holotype. What does that mean?
So a holotype is, it's the designation given to a specimen that is the first of its species to be found, to be studied, to be described and named and usually published in some kind of, you know, natural history journal, a scientific journal. And that's what happened to this butterfly that Johnny Hobson found in the snow that day. So Johnny Hobson, he's not a trained scientist, he didn't name it, but he passed that butterfly on to his friend, who was a very famous, well-respected entomologist, Dr. Gustavus Athol Waterhouse, who had accompanied him, Hobson, up onto Barrington Tops many times and discovered, you know, several butterflies of his own. He'd already named a butterfly after Johnny Hobson by the time he got around to this hair streak. And so he named it Barringtonensis after the place that he found it.
What's the scientific significance of a holotype? I mean, it's nice to be the first to be discovered, but is there a richer and deeper significance to a holotype in the world of entomology, in the world of insect science?
Yeah, so the idea is that these holotypes, they're kind of the foundation, the pillars of understanding about that species. So the idea is that they go to a natural history museum and it sits alongside dozens, tens, hundreds, thousands, maybe even millions of other specimens with a little red dot that means this is a particularly special one. And the holotype means that when future generations of scientists, it might be a decade, it might be 100 years from now, want to study that particular species, maybe they think the population numbers might have dwindled, they might have shifted location, you know, the climate might have changed. And to make sure that they're looking, they know that they're looking at this particular kind of butterfly, not one of the other ones that looks very similar to it. They go back to the source, they go back to the museum, they pull out the drawer, and they have a really close look. These days, they can do things like, you know, have electron microscopes and all these kinds of technologies, even DNA. Back in, you know, the 1920s, they were just looking very closely, illustrating it, describing it in language and publishing it.
So butterflies can be a bit like rings of bark on a tree or layers of ice in the Arctic shelf or the Antarctic shelf or something. Because they're so fragile and delicate, do they tend to tell us a lot about the environment of the place in that moment in time?
You know, when we talk about the broader natural kingdom, you know, it's easy to get people worked up about, you know, saving the pandas, saving something beautiful that we can, you know, anthropomorphize. But insects, we tend to, you know, swat them when we see them. We don't love them overall. But butterflies are kind of unique amongst the, you know, the insect kingdom, as, you know, generations and generations of butterfly collectors have very enthusiastically gone and collected them with their nets and their killing jars and collected this incredible, you know, catalogue, and they've named pretty much all of them. They're described as flagships, basically, the kind of the canaries, I guess. So if there are bigger changes that are affecting maybe the broader insect population, maybe we can use the butterflies to tell us that bigger story.
So we can learn so much because humans have been paying such close attention to butterflies.
Exactly.
What is it about a butterfly, do you think, that resonates and makes us so happy? You know, if you see a butterfly fluttering across your garden, it makes you really happy for some reason. What do you think that's about?
I think there's something about, you know, the beauty, the aesthetics of it is a huge part. You know, they catch the light in a really beautiful way. But then there's also, you know, they've been such, you know, the subjects of so much literature and writing. There's something about that kind of fragility, that transformation, that metamorphosis that, I don't know, just kind of draws people in. But also the challenge of it. Like, I don't know if you've ever tried to catch a butterfly. I haven't tried very hard, but they move, they can really move. So there is that kind of element of the chase to it as well, and that sense of achievement once they have collected them. Maybe not in the case of Johnny Hopson finding it in the snow, but that sense of achievement when you've managed to not only find where this particular butterfly lives and thrives, but then, you know, you've been patiently waiting and you've caught it in your net, and then, you know, you kind of snap its spine with your in between your fingers or put it in your killing jar and then you take it home. So there's this kind of very poignant, kind of morbid, but also sort of beautiful aspect to it.
They blaze so beautifully, but they're so fragile and they live such short lives. They metamorphose out of a cocoon. All those things, I suppose, touch on our own thinking, those kind of unbidden thoughts about life and death, don't they? Mm.
And loving something so much that you've got to kill it and take it home with you, I think is a strange and fascinating tension.
You're so beautiful. I'm going to capture you with a net, put a pin through your thorax and stick it on a board and inside a case, that kind of thing that humans do. We're marvellous creatures. So you mentioned Ethel Waterhouse there. That was this particular butterfly was passed on to a naturalist. Tell me why he was such an important figure in this world of Australian butterflies.
Yeah, so Ethel, he was a lifelong collector. He sort of started collecting shells around the beaches of Sydney with his mum when he was a little boy. And then, you know, as soon as he became a teenager, started building up this collection of his own. And eventually he would go on to basically, you know, write the book about Australian butterflies. And he was inspired as well. He was tapping into this bigger lineage. And that's another element I think that's really important about natural history is that, you know, all these collectors, they spend their lives, you know, catching as many butterflies as they can, you know, putting their names on them, putting their labels on the pins. But then when they die, they pass these collections to the museum, and there's something kind of altruistic, almost utopian about that, that they're contributing to this greater font of knowledge, this greater pool, which means, you know, future generations can look back and see what they did, but then they can also look back at what, you know, Joseph Banks even did, you know, centuries earlier. And that was certainly the case with Waterhouse. He, you know, invoked, you know, Joseph Banks being the first butterfly collector when the Endeavour rocked up on the eastern shore of the continent of Australia. And so he wrote these books. He was very respected in the museum world, and he was the president of the Australian Museum. And eventually, kind of around 1930, he decides to donate his life's collection to the Australian Museum in Sydney, around 50,000 plus at that point in his life.
Right, so this is a great trove that's not only a kind of a thing of wonder and beauty that's going to attract people into the museum, it's also an important scientific trove, I suppose, of knowledge and history and all those things. And he was going to give all 50,000 of his butterflies over to the Australian Museum.
And not only that, he was going to completely reconfigure the Australian Museum's existing collection around his own collection. So there's kind of very benevolent aspect to it, but there's also kind of, you know, you're sort of securing posterity for yourself too, a kind of life after death, which I found quite poignant.
And so this particular butterfly that had been picked up in the 1920s in Barrington Tops, that was part of that collection?
It was. And so, yeah, in the 1930s, it ends up in the Australian Museum. And for a long time, the broader scientific community assumed that's exactly where it stayed.
So fast forward now, all the way to 2016. You write that an email arrived in the inbox of a scientist called Dr. Michael Braby, and the email was from a collections manager at the Australian Museum in Sydney. And attached to it was an image that was supposed to be that holotype of that same butterfly retrieved from Barrington Tops way back in 1922, a century earlier. What did Michael Braby see when he looked at that picture attached to the email of this holotype?
Yeah, well, so he gets this email because he's been doing research into hair streaks, and he's doing exactly what that collection is for. He's comparing notes, trying to see if there's been any change in the population. He says they're particularly susceptible to, you know, changes in the environment, and gosh knows there's been a lot of changes in the environment in that kind of intervening century. But when he pulls up that attachment, he looks at it very closely at those red markings, and he thinks that that doesn't look quite right, that those markings don't look like they've been, you know, the product of evolution. He thinks they've been painted on.
What, like an Airfix model or something? Someone's got to it with a tiny paintbrush.
Or like one of those little, you know, Warhammer miniatures, I don't know. But there's a tiny little red streak, you know, the dash of a paintbrush, and that's all that it takes, and it took for a long time to make a related cousin hair streak look like the flame hair streak.
So it was a fake?
It was a fake.
What did he think had happened at first?
he had never encountered anything quite like that before, and he's, you know, a very experienced, very respected entomologist. He emails the Australian Museum. They're also flabbergasted. And the person he's working on this paper with, they sort of put their heads together. Initially, he thinks maybe someone else, you know, was studying it. Maybe they accidentally broke or damaged the specimen and swapped it out, you know, to hide their embarrassment. But, you know, scientists, you know, they have systems. They're all about systems. And so, you know, that happens. It's not great, but occasionally it happens. And they have, you know, processes for that. You know, there's a whole, you know, international zoological code about nomenclature because this world of taxonomy is so, you know, important to science. And so if they do have a new specimen that is kind of, well, that, you know, gets elevated from a backup type to, you know, the new kind of holotype to replace the lost one, it's called a neotype.
Right, that's like the understudy of the holotype.
It's the understudy.
Right, yeah.
And so, but if that happens, you know, there's a paper trail. It's not sitting there under, you know, Waterhouse's label from 1922. It's got a whole a documentation process behind it. So he discounts that theory, and pretty soon this other theory gets flagged about this case that sort of took hold of the world of natural history museums decades earlier, over half a century earlier, this butterfly heist.
So they pretty quickly realised that this butterfly, the original holotype, had been stolen, that butterfly that had been found in Barrington Tops way back in the 1920s. If they're seeing this tricked-up fake version of this butterfly and the spots are painted in just the right place, clearly the person who had stolen it must have known something about butterflies, must have known what they were doing and had a degree of expertise in the field of butterflies.
Absolutely, and you know, knew their way with a paintbrush as well. And Braby also, you know, he's a scientist and he has this very forensic way of looking at it. And the fact that the butterfly was caught dead means that the way it's pinned is even slightly different, because the pin punctures through this kind of slightly drier specimen than when if it was caught fresh, it's kind of a bit juicier.
Right.
It was a very vivid description.
Right. So the juices and guts of the butterfly normally assemble around the pin then, do they?
They do, yeah.
And fix it in place. So then the next best theory is it's attached to this heist that took place in the 1940s in Australia. How was this fraud first discovered in 1947 in Melbourne at the old National Museum of Victoria on Swanston Street?
Yeah, so one morning in January 1947, this entomologist, Alec Burns, at the National Museum of Victoria, he rocks up to work. It's his first day of work for the new year, and he goes into the museum. The museum doesn't open for a few hours, and he goes down into the basement to look at some butterflies. The museum has, just a few years earlier, finished acquiring the collection of Athol Waterhouse's best friend, lifelong collaborator, George Lyle, this, you know, probably the second most famous butterfly collector. And he has 50,000 plus butterflies and moths. And this collection is so fascinating that they've been running, like kind of rotating them through the main gallery. But there's so many that they have to, you know, swap out a dozen every couple of weeks. And so he's going down to bring some fresh butterflies up. And so he goes down into the basement. They call it the dungeons in those days because it was so dark and dingy. And he goes into the entomologist's room and he pulls out a drawer of birdwing butterflies. And he notices a few gaps. And initially, that's not necessarily cause for concern because, you know, when you're putting these collections together, you expect to add to them. So maybe you leave a few gaps for future additions. But he opens another drawer and then another drawer, and he keeps seeing more gaps, just a few at a time here and there. It's not like someone pulled out a drawer and just emptied them into a sack. Someone's been very strategic. And eventually,
right, so it's not whole trays that have gone missing. It's just like particular butterflies missing from these trays.
Yeah, someone's, you know, picked the eyes out of the collection.
Right.
To settle the matter beyond doubt, he pulls out a drawer of Ulysses butterflies, and he and his assistant, they know that this drawer is completely full. But when they open the drawer, it's not. And so they know, you know, without a doubt, something has gone down in the basement of the National Museum of Victoria. And they do a full count, a full audit, and the tally is over 800. Eventually, they bring in George Lyle himself, who by that point is a very old man. He kind of comes in and, you know, he knows this collection better than anyone. He ends up, you know, closer to 870 missing specimens. And then they put out the call to the other museums of Australia to check their collections. And that's when, you know, a few gaps in a collection begins to spiral from not only hundreds missing from Melbourne, but a nationwide serial butterfly heist.
How did Alec Burns twig to who the thief in question might be?
Yeah, the list of suspects, always a very short one. So he starts to think back to before, you know, the end of the previous year, 1946. So the last time he checked on these drawers was in October, November, and then he left work, he went out, as entomologists often do, and went out on a big field trip. So he was doing that. He went up into the Blue Mountains, into New South Wales, with a couple of entomologists, fellow collectors, and he had a great time. He netted a lot of butterflies, and he was hanging out with one guy in particular, an Englishman called Colin Wyatt, and they went up into these mountains in New South Wales and spent a weekend collecting with two other collectors. And then Burns came back to Melbourne, and then he went out again over Christmas. And early in the new year, he catches up with one of the other collectors that they went on that earlier trip with. And when Burns went back to Melbourne, this guy went with Colin Wyatt back to Sydney. And he told Burns that when he crashed overnight at Wyatt's house before going home, he noticed that, you know, Wyatt, who had just recently gotten a divorce, he seemed to have been packing up his life in Australia and preparing to head back to England. And that included several cases of butterflies that was, you know, sitting, waiting to be shipped back halfway across the world.
Right, and this guy thought, that's a little odd, funny, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's how he twigged that it might be Colin Wyatt. Tell me a bit about this man, Colin Wyatt, his background, how he became a butterfly obsessive.
So he, in many ways, is kind of the archetypal English gentleman collector. He's got this, you know, ginger hair, this moustache, you know, often seen in khaki. He was born in 1909 in England and was raised by, you know, his dad was already a very established mountaineer and collector and butterfly collector and skier, and kind of raised Colin from boyhood to become the ultimate gentleman naturalist and adventurer. And so by the time Colin passes through Cambridge, that's exactly who he has turned out to be. He is a champion skier. He's this artist. He spends his 20s, you know, going around the art schools of Europe, establishing himself as a painter of, you know, middling reputation, I think, but also having these incredible adventures up in the mountains and the Dolomites and the Alps.
He wrote several memoirs. What did he say happened when he went in search of a particular butterfly in the Italian Alps?
He had written his life story across three memoirs. And so the day I found out about the story, I went home and I bought the middle one, Going Wild, the autobiography of a bug hunter, off the internet and started reading. And he tells all these incredible stories, one of which is the day kind of in the early 1930s when he is up in the Alps, sort of between the border of Austria and Italy. And
now, World War II hasn't broken out yet, but Italy is being run by Mussolini, and they're becoming a little bit paranoid at this point.
There is, I would say, a vibe shift.
There's a vibe shift in
the
Italy.
Mountains of Italy.
Yep.
Because he kind of grew up in this age of kind of interwar freedom, but he could sense that the mood was turning, that, you know, there'd be signs along the border saying anyone caught crossing was liable to be shot. But he goes out on these bug hunting adventures. He's in his early 20s, and he's looking for a kind of fritillary butterfly. And he knows it's only located in a particular part of these mountains. And so he crosses the border. Well, he bumps into a couple of Italian border patrol officers, but he manages to win them over. But as he's going back towards the border, having kind of collected his fill, he notices a shortcut through the woods. And that's when he gets captured by another couple of patrolmen who aren't quite as accommodating. And he gets thrust in front of their commandant and forced to explain himself, this very sweaty young Englishman. And he doesn't speak Italian. And the commandant is not, he doesn't like any of the stories that he's trying to spin, until he produces, you know, this net and this butterfly collection. And suddenly the commander kind of shrugs and throws his hands up in the air and says, get rid of this, as they call him, the mad Inglese.
Well, it turns out Colin Wyatt had some form as a butterfly thief. And this came to pass in 1930, when 279 butterflies went missing from London's Natural History Museum in Kensington from the Parnassius collection of butterflies. Tell me how the keeper of that collection clocked who the thief was, and in fact that it was Colin Wyatt had stolen these butterflies.
So this is 1930, so Colin is still a very young man. He's, you know, still at Cambridge or fresh out of Cambridge perhaps. And Norman Riley, who's the head of entomology at the museum, he notices, you know, a couple of hundred Parnassius butterflies have gone missing. And like in Australia, you know, 17 years earlier, the list of potential suspects is very short. They showed the young Colin Wyatt through this collection a few weeks earlier, and Colin had apparently come and gone a few times after that to have a look at, you know, as was the way of things in those days. It was this very kind of collegiate, reciprocal relationship where collectors could come and study, and then eventually one day they'd donate their collections to the museum to add to that wealth that they have.
Or it could go the other way, as Colin Wyatt decided it might.
Occasionally it went the other way. Right. It's a real roll of the dice. And so he knows, you know, it may be this young man, Colin Wyatt. So he contacts the police and then has this strange kind of approach from a retired military man who was apparently a friend of the family, a friend of Colin's father and Colin himself. And this guy kind of came in, this brigadier, and tried to smooth things over. And eventually Colin Wyatt himself comes in and he has this very kind of awkward conversation with Norman Reilly, who...
Why has Colin Wyatt come back into the scene of the crime?
Well, initially it seems he sort of claims to be wanting to help. He says, oh, you know, I did see a few people come and go when I was there.
I will not rest until the culprit is found, that kind of thing.
He's just trying to be helpful, Richard.
Yeah, okay.
And, you know, pretty quickly Norman Reilly discounts all those other names and kind of the net in this conversation is gradually tightening around Colin. There's really no denying it. I think the tension in that room must have been pretty fierce. But in this very English kind of way, even though, you know, clearly something has gone awry in this very transgressive way.
Right. So they've had this conversation like, I know that you know that I know that you're the thief, that kind of thing.
Yeah, reading Norman Reilly's kind of contemporaneous account from 1930, that is definitely the vibe that I got. But Reilly says, look, at the end of the day, they've only been gone for a few days. If the butterflies came back intact, we probably wouldn't push it any further. And the very next day, somebody comes in and anonymously drops off 270-something Parnassus butterflies at the front desk, I guess, of the Natural History Museum, where they went missing just a few days earlier. And so Norman Reilly, you know, he doesn't pursue it any further, but I think informally around the Natural History Museum, around the basement entomology section, Colin Wyatt is quietly blacklisted from visiting.
So he arrives, first of all, in Australia in 1936, 3 years before World War II breaks out. He comes here on a boat, arrives in Sydney. How dazzled was Colin Wyatt by the butterflies that he found here?
Well, yeah, shortly after stepping off the boat at Sydney Harbour, he catches his first sight of what I think is a blue triangle, and he's clearly hooked on Australian butterflies, and that's his very first taste. And that's kind of the halfway point of this sort of 12-month tour of Australia and New Zealand that he has in 1936 and 1937. Because another thing that I think is important to note about Colin Wyatt is that he had this father who was this sort of adventurer in his own right in this kind of earlier age of mountaineering and exploration in the late 19th century, a period that Colin would later regard as a kind of golden age that by the time he came along, the Alps of Europe had kind of been gentrified. It wasn't quite this rugged wilderness that his father's generation had known and that he read about in all these incredible, you know, adventure books. So he came to Australia and New Zealand kind of hoping to have his own sort of taste of that rugged adventure. And that's what he did. And that's how he ended up in Sydney Harbour.
As you say, he'd been blacklisted from British natural history museums and no doubt in the gentlemen clubs of London, they'd be like, oh, he's a rum on that chap. But word of that hadn't filtered out here, had it?
No, and even across London necessarily, because before he returned to England in 1937, you know, making his way through Ceylon and having lots of adventures along the way. But he lived there for a few more years and then, you know, in his telling, the demand for his paintings had kind of dried up because, you know, belts were tightening, you know, war was approaching, and he decided to relocate again back to Australia, and this time he brought his new wife, a young woman named Mary. And when that was announced, it got a lot of coverage across, you know, the Tatler, all the society pages. So even though he was perhaps a persona non grata in the basement of the Natural History Museum, I don't think it had really filtered out across the London set necessarily.
War broke out while he was in Australia, and he became something called a camoufleur. What is a camoufleur?
So there was this funny movement in the late 1930s as, you know, war was clearly on the horizon, and this fascinating group of natural scientists, artists and engineers kind of formed in Sydney. They called themselves the Sydney Camouflage Group, led by the head of zoology at the University of Sydney, William Dakin. And they basically wanted to use all the lessons from the world of visual art and science and, you know, the natural world, so much camouflage across the animal kingdom, to figure out ways that they could apply it to the war effort, because they knew that Germany was doing all kinds of things on the camouflage front and they didn't want Australia to be left behind. So these were civilians, kind of, you know, of their own volition, going to, you know, putting together these manuals, putting together these theories, these tests. And so when war finally does break out, they managed to get the ear of Menzies and convince him to let them become an official part of the war kind of apparatus. And so they become part of the Department of Home Security and put this recruitment call out. And so the ranks of camoufleurs begin to grow, including some pretty big names. The photographer Max Dupain was one of them. A lot of these other modern artists, William de Bell, I think, was enlisted to make some fake papier-mâché cows at one of the kind of fake airfields that they tried to, you know, disguise as just a paddock.
Sorry, William de Bell made giant papier-mâché cows for a fake airfield for RAAF training? Is that what's in the record? Wow.
Yeah, just normal stuff.
Like, we'd all pitch in.
They were trying different things. It was you know, a period of experimentation. And so Dupain and Wyatt would go up on these kind of reconnaissance flights where they're sort of half hanging out of these, you know, military planes, taking aerial photographs of the things that they've tried to camouflage to see if they can be detected from above.
So they're trying to create camouflage in case Australia's invaded?
Yeah.
Is that the idea? And so Australian soldiers can then melt into the Australian wilderness.
And infrastructure as well. A lot of outposts shrouded in fake concrete rock formations and things like that. A lot of netting.
So meanwhile, Colin White meets the grandfather or godfather of Australian butterfly science, which Athol Warthouse, whom we were talking about earlier, the man with the gigantic butterfly collection that he's going to donate to the Australian Museum. How did the two men get on initially, Athol Warthouse and Colin White?
Well, initially, Colin has a pretty good in that in New South Wales, he is the first person to notice a caper white moth or butterfly. And this is a pest that's been kind of making its way across the world, New Zealand, and then came over to Victoria, and he was the first person to spot it in New South Wales. And that's, you know, a scientific breakthrough development. And Athol must have caught wind of that because he wrote it up in the Australian Museum magazine that this man, Colin White, had made this discovery. And then obviously they kept talking. They started going out on trips together, you know, in the northern suburbs of Sydney, a bit further out, and started collecting. And so in a subsequent issue of the Australian Museum magazine, Warthouse talks about his fun experiments out in the country collecting butterflies with this Englishman, Colin White, including they were discussing there's this particular breed that Warthouse was famous for collecting, but it was really hard to catch in the wild, but they knew that they were attracted to certain bright colours. And Warthouse flags this theory to Wyatt, and Wyatt pulls out some sort of squares of coloured, red and blue coloured foil from his bag and cuts them into the shapes of butterflies, climbs up this tree, and Warthouse is in his 60s at this point. His tree climbing days, doctors have very specifically told him to stop climbing trees much earlier on. And Wyatt, you know, bounds up this tree, puts these fake butterflies in place and watches as the butterflies are attracted to the red specimens. So they have a great time, and he writes about it, Warthouse, glowingly in the Australian Museum magazine. You know, he calls Wyatt his friend. You know, to anyone reading, it seemed like they were, you know, two great collector friends.
So how did Warthouse then come to have doubts about the gent?
Well, there are a few things that kind of, yeah, sow those doubts. One of their collecting trips, they go into the Blue Mountains, and Colin makes a very casual remark that, oh, there's a new aerodrome not far from here. And Warthouse, you know, we're at war. He has two twin sons that are both, you know, have been listed and are part of the war effort. And that kind of casual disclosure of, you know, military infrastructure, you know, raised some eyebrows with him. And he just started to think that maybe all of Wyatt's amazing stories about collecting rare butterflies around the world, just maybe they were too good to be true.
Right.
And so he sends this letter in, I think, 1942, so just not long after they go out on their butterfly fake decoy planting trip. And he very casually, in this letter to a friend at the Natural History Museum, name drops Colin Wyatt. And almost immediately he gets a telegram from Norman Riley, the head of entomology at the Natural History Museum.
The same guy who'd interrogated him about the missing Parnassus butterflies from the Natural History Museum in London.
And it says, do not trust landscape painter writing.
Landscape painter being Colin White.
Colin White.
Right.
Yeah. And Warthouse, you know, must have thought a lot of things. But, you know, the fact that he didn't name White specifically just kind of alluded to him as this landscape painter. and that he was obviously writing with more information, you know, tripped some alarm bells, and Waterhouse alerted the authorities. He told the security services because he knew that Wyatt was doing this war work, this camouflage work, and maybe was exposed to sensitive information, and if he wasn't to be trusted, that's something they should know about. The security services already had a folder. They had been looking into Colin Wyatt since almost the day that he stood off the boat in 1939, because he arrived the day after war was declared. He was this kind of globe-trotting, multilingual adventurer who'd been all through, like his passport was stamped with all these locations across Europe.
Oh, he'd spent a lot of time in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, yeah, probably too.
Exactly.
So they thought he might be a spy.
And so, you know, almost immediately, while he's working in the Department of Information, some police officers knock on the door of the apartment that they're kind of set up in Potts Point, and his wife, Mary, his new wife, answers the door, and they question her. They look at his passport, but they, you know, decide he's probably not a threat.
What motivates the thief? He's clearly an obsessive about butterflies.
Mm.
But I wonder if he has also that, this is pure speculation, this trait in him that likes the idea that I can do these things under everyone's nose, and it's something only I know about, and I'm cleverer than everyone because I've been able to perpetrate this thing. That's the classic kind of mentality of the spy in a lot of ways.
It's very hard to know, and I don't personally think he was a spy. But then there's also, you know, it's just very funny to think that the precursor to ASIO during the war was, you know, following, you know, the newspapers in Sydney in the early 1940s to spot mentions of his wife, you know, out in society doing fundraisers, but also Colin Wyatt exhibiting art with the Contemporary Art Society and all these, you know, surrealists like, you know, Sidney Nolan, and passing commentary on modern art, which they kind of thought was rubbish.
So we come full circle now here to 1947. So the collection, the missing butterflies being discovered in the collection in the National Museum of Victoria. Audits are done in museums in Adelaide and in Sydney. More and more butterflies have gone missing from there. Thousands of butterflies have gone missing from there altogether. But Wyatt, at this point, had shot through.
Mm.
Once this theft is discovered, he's shot through. He's gone back to England. How did the long arm of the law eventually catch up with him in England?
As soon as they realise that Wyatt is the most likely suspect and that he had just gone back to his mother country, they contacted a scientist at the Natural History Museum, someone who had spent a lot of time working in Australia, so knew all those collections, and had actually, he'd been based in Tasmania during the first part of the war, and he'd actually met Colin Wyatt. Colin Wyatt had come down to Tasmania and had brought with him a letter of introduction from Waterhouse himself. And so this guy contacts Scotland Yard. Scotland Yard don't really know what to make of this entomologist and this kind of extraordinary story of missing butterflies from...
Is it hard to get them to care as well? Like, he stole what? Butterflies. It's not. I suppose it, to them it doesn't look like a vast sum of money or gold bars or whatever.
Absolutely. He has to really kind of push to make them take the case seriously. And there's still, you know, it's still just hearsay from these museums in Australia. So the police over in England, they're waiting for more evidence to be compiled, for these lists to be posted over. But eventually they, you know, this one detective is convinced they have enough evidence, and they decide to go to visit Colin Wyatt, where he's currently based at his mother's house in Surrey. And he catches the train out there. He doesn't go alone. He brings with him Norman Riley himself. So Riley had tried to warn the Australians about it. They hadn't heeded that warning one or another, and now he was charged with catching the train out to Wyatt's mother's house. So he and this detective and a local police officer, they, you know, turn up to the front door. And surely enough, Colin Wyatt's there, and so are these cases that they, he had just shipped back to England with him from Sydney. I think at that point they were probably mostly empty because he'd spent a good week, you know, the middle of winter, it was snowing outside. So he had spent this, you know, week cozy in his mother's house, re-sorting all these butterflies and putting them in this new cabinet that he had at the house and, you know, repinning them and, as we later found out, changing a lot of the labels. And so he had this whole collection, and he actually wrote this letter, which is in the Melbourne Museum archives, where he wrote to a collector back in Australia, and he tells this story about how I just had this great week working on my Australian collection, and he even name drops specific specimens that Burns, a specific species that Burns had noticed missing, you know, a few weeks earlier over in England. So he was putting up this kind of facade right up until the very end, and this letter was written just a few days before Riley came knocking with the police.
What was his motivation? He's pulling these specimens out of their museum cases, giving them false labels, and then putting them in his own case instead. Is he going to sell them, or does he just want them for himself?
Yeah, I don't think he did plan to sell them. I think it was just the act of of having them. And it's one of the real ongoing inscrutable questions of this case. One, that Wyatt was such an unreliable narrator. Even, you know, that story I told from his memoir about being caught up with the Italian police.
Who knows if that is true?
Who knows if it's true? But yeah. Also in the book he says, you know, pretty much that that's the closest he's come to, a brush with the law, which by the time that was written in the 1950s when I read that.
Absolutely was not true. He'd been arrested, right? He'd been busted.
Yeah. So he's always putting up this kind of front, this facade to different, you know, audiences. But even if he had this collection, anyone who knew butterflies enough to appreciate the length, you know, how amazing it was, you know, those experts, they also know that only Norman Tyndale had gone to that island off the northern coast of Australia and collected that specific specimen that now has a label saying Colin Wyatt caught it, but a few months earlier said that Tyndale had.
So he was relabeling them to say that he had caught these specimens himself.
Exactly. And also a few pseudonyms just thrown into the mix there. So a few of them he had name dropped G. Purcell, which was another, you know, random young guy who was in the camouflage unit who had gotten into butterfly collecting while, you know, because a lot of people got into butterfly collecting in New Guinea because there were so many. It was a bit of a craze. At one point, the officers told them to stop turning their mosquito nets into butterfly nets because it was just so dangerous.
So let me ask you then, in renaming them like this and rebadging them to make it seem like they'd been caught by him and were his property, what damage had he done to their scientific integrity?
The whole point of these collections is to have that data. You know, the butterfly itself is, you know, important and interesting to look at, and you can get up really close to those details, but so is this very specific information about where and when it was found, what season. And so if you muck with that, you really undermine the integrity of that whole batch of data. And even months later, when they did recover these specimens, bring them back to Australia, some of the entomologists who were passing through this, you know, enormous mess, they couldn't help but notice that, you know, White had, in some instances, he'd changed maybe the year and maybe, you know, he'd put his name in, but he'd kept the locations and the sort of month the same. So it was kind of just close. It was close enough to the truth to be accurate for, you know, scientific purposes in some sense, but also, you know, he'd fundamentally rewritten the labels and undermined all the integrity. So they don't really know where these butterflies could have come from.
So what's your sense of him then? Is he purely an insane butterfly obsessive collector, or is he a kind of inveterate trickster, or both?
I think he was a man kind of enthralled to these narratives of collection and the thrill of having this sort of becoming, you know, within touching distance of greatness, of having this collection, of having these adventures.
He's been busted at his mum's house in Surrey with all these stolen cases of thousands of stolen butterflies that he's rebadging and making a mess of the science of the whole thing. Was he charged?
Yeah, so there's this incredible back and forth where the Australian museums, you know, they want to extradite him to Australia, and the governments of the day are like, no, that's going to cost money. Let the UK deal with it. And so eventually it goes to court, and the entomologists at the London Museum, they've tried to build this, you know, quite moving dossier of evidence where they try to articulate these important tenets of natural history of science to police and prosecutors and a judge of how important these collections are. But also,
oh, you've got to get them to care. That's the hard thing.
You've got to get them to care. And,
right.
And also how, you know, these labels are the evidence of where these butterflies should have come from, and how you can use this data set to build a case that these butterflies were stolen. But they go to all this effort. They even put together a sample of these cases. They wake up really early in the morning. They bring them to the West Ham Magistrates Court, and the cases are sitting there on the table where the lawyers are. And then when this trial gets underway, Wyatt is initially charged with, I think, taking possession of these butterflies, which is kind of akin to stealing them to begin with.
Yeah, it's possession of stolen goods.
But immediately it gets downgraded to just having them, which is a lesser charge.
Right, but he's clearly the thief.
Yeah, but they can't prove it because it happened in Australia. None of the entomologists, none of them can definitively prove that they're from Australia. They're not the Australian entomologists themselves. You know, confronted with this case, the prosecutor at the time and maybe the judge too couldn't quite get their heads around. Couldn't be made
right,
to care.
Right, they waved it away. And what? So this is a misdemeanor then, really, then, is
essentially.
It?
And so, and the, even the prosecutor, he kind of reads out, you know, Wyatt's confession from when he was first confronted, and he puts on, like, he kind of acquits Wyatt pretty handsomely. He says that, you know, this was, you know, he otherwise has a pretty unimpugnable character. He has a clean record. all this, you know, glowing, these glowing terms. And then that's before the defence, you know, starts up. And the defence lays on this story of, you know, how Colin was a sickly boy and his one kind of outlet was butterfly collecting. And then when he was in Australia, he went there. He was this lonely boy. Finally, he found love and acceptance when he got married. And then that marriage crumbled and he was so distraught by that he retreated into his earlier hobby of collecting butterflies. They did specifically say his only hobby, which I thought was a bit of a stretch. He has many, many diverse interests. So they basically wrote off these thefts as this sort of, you know, he's under psychological pressure, having a bit of a breakdown. He took leave of his senses, essentially. Even though this, by any stretch, was a methodical heist in many cities over many, many visits. And I've been to the Australian Museum and I've seen these butterflies that have been recovered. Some of them are tiny, some of them are fragile. You could fit a couple of dozen in a jar, as he claimed to, and, you know, put them in your jacket pocket and get out the front door. Some of them are, you know, the size of the palm of your hand. And they looked pretty intact. So that at some point as well, from the museum's perspective, like it's very unflattering for their own security, but also, you know, the more questions they ask, you know, the more unflattering it is. So at some point, you know, the police
stop asking questions.
Exactly.
Right.
And so it's puzzling that he could have gotten thousands out the door.
So you say after this, he's given a slap across the wrist and a fine pretty much. So after this, he writes these memoirs that you've read and he says that incident with the Italian police up in the Alps, the border police, was his closest brush with the law. Does that mean he never mentioned the theft?
Never mentioned the theft.
Not at all.
And that was what really drew me into the story. You know, the butterfly theft, you know, that's interesting and he's this fascinating character. But the fact that there was this body of writing of, you know, his life story, but it had this fundamental kind of unreliability to it, that there were aspects of his story, of his legend that he was deliberately leaving out, that just really struck me as, you know, when we're talking about museums and the way that he managed to pull off this heist, you know, it wasn't through, you know, he didn't climb up the big ladder leaning against the outside of the museum and sort of spelunk down from the ceiling. He walked in. He was welcomed in because he looked and sounded like he belonged there. And I think that says a lot about the values of these museum systems and the way they were built on generations of gentlemen collectors who went out and collected the world, sort of went where they want, went as they pleased, took what they want and brought it back to the museums. And, you know, those kind of legacies museums grapple with today of, you know, we've got a lot of stuff that maybe shouldn't be here and you have to, you know, send it back potentially. But then also that kind of broader theme of history and what parts of the story are left out of that, you know, the mythology of the golden age of exploration. What are the darker things that are left off the page? And in its own way, this butterfly heist and this butterfly thief was kind of a microcosm of that at work.
How did Colin Wyatt meet his end?
He walks out of the courtroom and immediately goes off to Europe. He goes off on another skiing holiday. He continues to have these adventures. He writes these memoirs in the 1950s. He pivots to being a writer. You know, he goes across northern Canada, hanging out with the Inuit people and going on all these adventures. And by the 1960s, he pops up in these newspapers kind of as a touring lecturer. He gives these talks to, you know, women's groups and church groups around the country and has a projector where he shows slides and films of his adventures.
So how did he meet his end?
Well, so by the 1970s, he has pivoted. He's still taking photos and he's not painting as much, but his new area of interest and perhaps obsession is Mayan culture, Mayan civilization. And so by this point, he has a daughter and she's grown up. He spends the 1960s basically, his second ex-wife, who was the mother of that daughter, she's passed away. So he does spend a lot of the 60s kind of at home in Surrey in his mother's old house raising this daughter. By the 1970s, she's old enough to be at uni. She's left home and he's thinking about relocating to Guatemala, to Central America, to pursue this new area of interest. And in late 1976, he's on this tour through Central America and he writes to his daughter back in England and he says, I've changed my itinerary because I've got a tip-off that there is this ruined Mayan city that people know about, but he's heard that there's this other area that might have another kind of unexcavated, undiscovered Mayan ruin.
So he's an archaeologist now.
Yeah, he's pivoted to archaeology. And he's always kind of been interested in those sort of cultures on his travels, one of his many hobbies. But he tells her he's changed his plans and he's managed to get himself a plane on a once-a-week flight in the Guatemalan national carrier. It's a small flight, just kind of locals being ferried back and forth in this kind of jungle runway. That letter arrives after that plane has already crashed. So he dies on this morning in November 1975. The plane takes off, the weather's bad, and pretty soon it comes to ruin in the jungles of Guatemala.
So he died in this flaming plane crash.
Yeah.
How was his body identified afterwards?
Part of this, writing this story, was actually, you know, made contact with his daughter, and she has very complicated feelings about his life, his story, how people talk about his life and legacy. She told me that, you know, it was this, the signet ring of this, the Wyatt family, this architectural dynasty, that was what identified the body.
Was the holotype of that butterfly we spoke about right at the beginning, the fake one of which was discovered in 2016, was the real holotype that he'd stolen ever recovered?
Yeah. It had been, in fact, in the Australian Museum the whole time. So when they recovered these butterflies and they brought them back to Australia after the trial, they tried to make sense of them in Adelaide. It was a total mess. The labels had been changed. They had to do things like, they knew Waterhouse preferred black enamel pins. That was how they figured out which ones were the Waterhouse butterflies. But the collections and these thousands of butterflies, the labels had been so fundamentally compromised that they decided to print out thousands of yellow labels that they would attach to every single recovered specimen that said that these passed through the Wyatt theft collection 1946 to 1947.
So there are thousands of butterflies, specimens, that are labelled as having passed through the Wyatt theft collection.
Yeah. So his name lives on in all these collections that he stole from, you know, pinned right up against, in many cases, the names of the collectors who originally collected them. And surely enough, when they realised it might have a connection to this case, they went and had a look at this, the recovered butterflies with the yellow labels, and they found this other flame hair streak with a label on it that claimed to have been collected by C. Wyatt in 1942 at Barrington Tops.
No fake painting on it. This is the real thing. The red dots are real.
And importantly, Braby was able to notice that the puncture hole from the pin looked like it had been caught dead.
What a great story. What a great yarn. Such a pleasure speaking with you, Walter. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Richard.
Walter Marsh's book is called The Butterfly Thief. Today's conversation with Walter Marsh was made in the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer was Jennifer Leake. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.